The Loose Cannons Podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
I don't know what the hell it is. What is she? A political fantasy? Frustrated vision of Sarah's own inability? I don't know anything about this play. I don't know anything about this woman. I told my wife tonight. I said, Dorothy, I don't know what this play is about. I don't know what this woman is about.
Manny, she's not even like some bum, you know? She's not even a bum. Just a bitch. She's nothing. I mean, if I play her the way everybody wants me to play her, like some little over-the-hill matron, my career is over. I'm sick to death of hearing how old this woman is. Who gives a damn how old this woman is? Does she win or does she lose? That's what I want to know.
I know.
Hey, everybody. It is another Loose Cannons mini episode coming at ya. This, as you could probably tell if you listen to the podcast regularly, is Basil. I'm hosting it this time, and we got two people, one regular guest and one first-time guest joining us to talk about Opening Night, directed by John Cassavetes. So, first person, Mitchell, what's up?
Hey, how's it going? Great to be back.
Yeah. New York's own.
Yeah, they say that. They say that. I sort of run the Big Apple these days. Yeah.
All right. And first time guest, she's been mentioned on the podcast tons and tons of times by me.
Ooh.
But Haley is here.
Hi, I'm here. I'm a real person.
Yep, I didn't make her a fat girl.
Wow, this build up was worth it. The big reveal.
It'll be like a Fight Club situation. I listen back to the episode and it's just me doing two different voices.
Hey, that kind of connects into this movie a little bit.
That's true.
There was a very Fight Club-esque scene.
Yeah. All right. So I'll just give the plot description and then we'll all go around. So this movie is Gina Rowlands is a stage actor in New York, and she's working on a new play about aging and seemingly having trouble kind of connecting to the character. And then while they're leaving the theater one night, a fan comes up to her to try and engage, and then they engage briefly and go away. And then it seems as if the woman is hit by a car while she's yelling after their limo and dies. And then kind of becomes Gina Rowlands trying to handle this idea of like dealing with aging, but also this kind of strange grief she feels about the dead fan. And the fan starts appearing when she's alone, and it's a big what to do, whether she's going crazy, whether it's a ghost, or whether the fan even existed in the first place, because no one else seems as concerned about the her getting hit by a car as she is. So yeah, I mean, that's the more or less the plot of the movie. What did you think of this movie, Mitchell?
Oh, I liked this movie. I haven't watched a Cassavetes movie in a long while. I'm glad y'all got me to come back and watch this. I should go through his filmography. There's not much. On the surface, it seems kind of straightforward. I mean, just based on that plot synopsis alone, it could be like misleadingly simple sounding. But I mean, the movie is so dense and stacked and moves in such very strange, bizarre ways. even though I think I have like a good grip on what he's getting at and what like the primary themes of the movie are, there's still lots of things that I find elusive in this. It's a pretty mysterious movie. And I love that Cassavetes crew. Those actors are so much fun. Love Ben Gazzara, love Cassavetes himself. Gina Rowland's always great. I had a good time with this one. It was very, very gripping. One of the first times in a while that I like sat down to watch a movie at home and didn't just like constantly check my phone and space out for large chunks. So that's some sort of endorsement.
All right.
Haley? I really like this movie. It took me a little while to get into it because of just having watched Faces and Husbands. It didn't initially have the same kind of like spontaneity as those movies that I really found compelling. But then, I don't know, once I got into it, I really liked it. And I ended up watching it twice, actually. And yeah, I like, there's like a lot of ambiguity there, especially with like the ghost, like whether it's like some kind of alcoholic hallucination or like actually a thing that she's doing as part of her like creative process or whatever. Yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah. Oh. I like this movie a lot too. The beginning of it had like a weird horror movie vibe that I thought was very interesting. Like it reminded me a lot of, even though it comes later, obviously, Dario Argento's opera, where it's like this strange sort of, that takes place in an opera, obviously, but the similar, like, you know, stage and creepiness. There's like a weird part where early on there's this kind of creepy sound that sounds like really abstract, but then it turns into like audience applause, like you're like, it's like easier to understand. And just some of the ways that he shoots things, I was like, oh, this really reminds me of like weird giallo or Rosemary's Baby a certain amount when they're trying to gaslight her.
Well, Cassavetes couldn't shake those baby vibes.
It's true. But it is very interesting. I mean, I'm curious to rewatch Killing of a Chinese Bookie also, because it's kind of interesting to see him like take something that in a way feels a little more like genre-y, but then apply his like pretty unique aesthetic to it and unique way of like having actors interact with each other. So I was pretty on board for that.
Yeah, that opening's really cool. I like the way it cuts to the title card. I mean, the opening's essentially you watching people watch a play, and then it then it cuts very dramatically to the production card. It's pretty great.
And like the way that the play is sort of shot early on is very unnerving, like the POV shots from the audience. I was like, oh, this, it's just watching a play, but feels really voyeuristic in a way that's unsettling.
And when Nancy approaches her, like in the beginning, it's also like really immediately off-putting. This person is immediately like crazy and like, I don't know,
mumbling,
doesn't seem
a lot
appealing to be a fan.
All the shots of the actual stage are like all like just off center too. They're very strange shots. They're not what you would expect a person to center like a stage shot on. They're always just off to the right a little bit. Very weird. I didn't like that. But I liked that. I didn't like that.
The way that Cassavetes shoots in general, I think is like one of the more underrated aspects of his filmography, because people talk about, you know, the kind of freewheeling scripts and the performances and stuff like that, that he's like an actor's director, but something about the way that he shoots close-ups are so like, I don't know, like nothing much will be happening, but then he just like cuts to a person's face and I'm like, oh, I feel really sad looking at this right now. There's nothing like that seems like it should be sad on the surface of it, but he's good with those close-ups.
Yes. Oh man, that the fan in question. She's that's an interesting point to leap off from, I think. that's a very mm-hmm. bizarre character. You kind of get like three layers to her that all sort of contradict one another and are sort of hard to cohere into an actual person, which is probably the point. She's never an actual person to any of them to varying degrees, but right. we're introduced to her as somebody who doesn't necessarily seem well, seems mentally ill to some extent, and mumbles most of her dialogue. And then we're introduced to her family later at the funeral. And they seem to be some sort of like very conservative Jewish family. And then when we see her again in like these reveries or in this ghost state, she's like, just, I mean, she's just young Gina Rowlands, basically. Just a whole other entry point to it. I don't know. I'm still working on that stuff. This yeah, absent lady it's... is something.
Yeah, it's a tough movie. I was excited to do it for the for a mini episode, but it's also a pretty dense movie to be yeah. trying to unpack this.
And like even the title of the play, like The Second Woman, it's like, who is the second woman? Is it the ghost? Is it Sarah? Or is it like even Ben Gazzara's wife is like really yeah. heavily featured in it, and it like ends with her embracing Gina Rowlands, and like so she's really important. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot going on with the second woman thing. Oh, and then like herself in the play.
Yeah,
well. She's
the old version woman. Of her is the second woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the stuff with Ben Gazzara's wife is like super strange. Where like he has that extremely frank conversation on the phone right in front of her, where she's like, sorry, I'm talking to Gina Rowlands right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is her name? Her character's name
Myrtle,
yeah. And like if it's like very flirtatious, and she just seems somehow fine with it, like
well because he's like indulging her. Mm-hmm. It's like this thing that everyone has to do around her is like constantly coddle and indulge her ego, and like his wife understands this like what he's doing in that right. moment, even if there's like some level of sincerity to it as well.
Yeah,
it's just like how everyone has to interact with her.
Yeah, but like they don't actually explicitly ever lay that out. So when you're first introduced to Ben Gazzara doing that, it like seems like they're having an affair or something, but then the wife comes into the scene too and is cool with it. So it's just like generally off-putting. sort of shines a light on that behavior in a way that doesn't seem the healthiest. I think this whole this cast isn't necessarily in a very great place to begin with, and then the catalyst mm-hmm. of this lady maybe or maybe not dying is kind of what throws her off, but they're all kind of people who have warped reality to better their occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, where's the line? I'm also wondering, is the play supposed to be good? I don't think it's supposed to be good.
I thought it was supposed to be like too maudlin, too serious,
yeah.
and I felt like that's why they end up kind of making fun of it almost, like right. at the end.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. She seems very upset.
Yeah.
That's what they end up doing to her play. Yeah, and that was one of the things that actually drew me into the movie right away. Was like when it starts with the performance, I'm like, oh, this is like perfectly like cheesy. Like Broadway dialogue. I'm like,
yeah.
Cassavetes has seen a lot of like very mediocre plays because
yeah.
this feels exactly like my experience of watching a lot of them.
Yeah, but it's like really well calibrated too, where if you were just kind of watching it passively, you could just kind of assume like, oh yeah, plays the play. But like, I think it must be like, he must have like really heavily worked on that. It's like really perfectly mediocre and dumb.
Yeah.
The second woman. Yeah. And then once like the whole opening scene's about, I mean, it like the movie goes on to contradict it, but it's what's Cassavetes' character talking about how like old people are inherently kinder and like
yeah.
spouting cliches about like, oh, look at all those wrinkles, like every wrinkle's like connected to like a pain or something, and it's like, well,
yeah.
that's not really true. People aren't trees.
And, yeah, and then, like, because you don't know at that moment than on reflection back or whatever. It like seems very self-serving of Sarah to like write this thing about how great old people are when she's like really neurotic about her age or whatever.
Yeah.
I was wondering how you guys felt about Sarah, actually, because that was like a like something about the movie that I felt a little mixed on, where it seemed like her character didn't feel like a character in a Cassavetes movie to me, because at least to me she seemed like so clearly like the villain, and that kind of complicated how I felt about Gina just like destroying her play. And like it seemed like a triumph that she did it in a way, and I was like, I don't know if it should feel this way, but the way she's just like always needling her about her age and saying stuff like, oh, acting is just like saying lines with emotion, and then my character will come through because of, you know, what I wrote. And like, it just seems like she's so like, I never felt like as like sympathetic or ambiguous about her as like the other characters, or I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, that she comes across like a little more like she doesn't have the nuance that, because I feel like all the characters are kind of like not particularly likable people, as is often the case in Cassavetes movies, but they have a little more roundedness to their unlikable qualities.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Like, she doesn't have. Although, I mean, I guess I felt slightly sympathetic to her just in the fact that, you know, it does seem hard to be a writer in any kind of performing art, because, you know, you're leaving what you've written up to other people to interpret and then create the actual art with. Your thing is just the template. Seems like if you have any kind of ego, being a screenwriter especially, would be very hard.
Yeah, she kind of comes off maybe more as like a screenwriter tool that Cassavetes is using, more so than like a fully fleshed out character like the Everyone. And everybody else gets like so much more substantial screen time, and their dialogue's a lot more interesting. She definitely feels like a way of kind of like more directly interrogating this conflict about like age and like dignity within both art and life. It's interesting that she's like paired off with the producer character all the time too. Like, I feel like they're probably supposed to serve similar functions. They're kind of like two sides of the same coin, where he's like just sort of like a passive mind. Like, they're sort of like gatekeepery types of some sort, who kind of want to like map on easy morals onto like real life conflict. Like, and then Gina Rowlands is pushing back on that. Yeah, but then, like, she would sort of become sympathetic, too. She would sort of, like, seem to get what's going on with Gina Rowlands, but also not. Like, the spiritualist scene seems well-intended, but maybe that exacerbates issues. It certainly, like...
Yeah, it did seem to be not a good thing.
Yeah, it definitely exacerbates her, like, on a misunderstanding of what's going on. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, it sort of goes back to, like... I mean, it's the most, I think, I guess, like, literal of what kind of everyone is trying to do, which is like, oh, we need this play to happen because, and Gina Rowlands is, like, the lead, so she needs to be in it, so that she's like, oh, well, I'll take care of this, we can go to my spiritualist. It's just, like, a lot of people looking for, like, quick fixes for this, like, pretty intense existential problem that Gina Rowlands is having, and then, you know, I mean, it's not about, like, really trying to grapple with what she's struggling with. They're just like, the show must go on. We gotta fix this issue.
Yeah.
I like the part when she's, like, defending it. She's like, oh, she's just someone I make up, you know, so I can act. I'll do anything. I'll stay up late. I'll drink all night. Anything for my art.
Yep.
She's a real martyr. Yeah. But I did like that conceptualization too, because if you did take her at face value and that is what she's doing, I do think it, I mean, I've never really acted, so I can't actually say if this is true, but like it does sort of fit into what I imagine actors do to get into a character. It seems like a pretty good literal representation of that. So I was on her side for a while, but then the thing she created or is imagining and starts attacking her and beating her up, and then it starts to seem like a problem. Maybe it's like a big metaphor for method acting. The old Joker situation. Watch out for that far. Joker. Yep. Take over your mind.
Poor Heath. Can't escape.
Yeah. Hard headspace to exit. I mean, that's like a very Cassavetes thing too, where like the movie's like sort of a metaphor for like the filmmaking process or the process of making art, but he like won't let it be that easy or simple either, which is good because that would be boring. And so there's like all this extra stuff, and so it's like sort of about like the murkiness of the process, and you're like watching the process, but he's calling the process into question at the same time. I like that. I think that's a connection with Killing of a Chinese Bookie as well, where as you suggested, is kind of like a seemingly genre setup, but it's kind of all about like where the lines are of like your dignity and your belief in your art as you're creating it, and to what extent you'll go to, and to what extent it's worth it, and to what extent you're like bringing it upon yourself and like worsening your own neuroses and complicating your own life unnecessarily.
Yeah, it's also like, I don't know, like I think you can read it like she's doing all this stuff because she's kind of like a genius at her art, and it requires her to be this way and to like have like she has like this deep integrity about what she's doing. But then also it seems like, no, she's just like this narcissist that wants to control everything.
Yeah.
And then like, where's that line between like her having this kind of genius for acting and then, or just being kind of crazy and wanting to draw attention to herself and portray herself in the way she wants to be portrayed. And
yeah, I mean, the way that that unfolds in terms of like, especially with the previews, is very funny, where she just like keeps ruining the production like in front of people, and you know, she's like, why worry about it? It's only a play.
Yeah, and it seems like very directed at Sarah. Like, she tells Sarah, like, we'll never be friends. Like, she hates Sarah, but she's ruining her play on purpose. And she also wants Maurice to throw himself under the bus and, like, you know, improvise with her on the stage because it might threaten his career. Like, right before they go up on that final scene together, she's like, I forget what she says. It's something like, I'm gonna bring that guy down or something.
Yeah, because before that she tries to like seemingly tries to collaborate with him, where she's like, oh, you know, let's work on this thing, let's see if we can bring some real life out of this, like,
yeah,
basically like out of this shitty play. And then he's like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, you're a star, you can do whatever you want, but like, I'm just like a bit player in this play, like,
yeah,
I need this.
But it does seem at the end that he's the one that actually like is like, okay, I'm just gonna do this then, and then do what she wants to do.
He gives in, but then it ends up working out, and they have that ridiculous scene together with the shaking hands.
Yeah, friend. Which is funny too, because I feel like every time she fucks it up before in the previews, it still ends up working out too. They still get applause and stuff, and so there's this interesting subtext throughout where it's like, to what extent does it matter? To like what extent is the audience just like going to interpret it as good anyway, or just like get something out of the thrill and like immediacy of being in the theater, like, especially in the preview stage, like they don't actually know. And I think there's like a couple like lines of dialogue that like discuss people not liking the play, but like you never see any audience members actually say that. Like, it's usually met with like applause and adulation from the audience, which is funny. Do they want all
that? I think that ties into sort of like where, I mean, I think obviously less successfully, but where Iñárritu goes with Birdman with Edward Norton's character, that he's just like the star of Broadway, and when you're a star, people are going in like, you know, expecting the feeling of loving you. So they're just like primed to like basically whatever you do.
Yeah.
That means you can just show up so drunk that you can barely stand and people will gobble it up.
Yeah,
that was great.
It was so real.
Oh, I was also thinking about that, like, at the end when she's like, yeah, so drunk, she's like half alive, mm-hmm. but they can still do the scene with her. Like, he just has to kind of like hold her up a little bit more. But like the way they show that, like all her scenes in that play early on, like she's just so passive and demure and just being subject to people yelling and slapping her and stuff, so she can just be in this play and be like half dead and it right. like still yeah. like yeah. works.
It doesn't affect the character.
It's like a really boring role for a woman.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, it is an interesting also, I mean, she says it pretty explicitly, but like the sort of commentary of like, oh, once I accept this role, like that's how people see me or whatever, like that, you know, like and I'm sure that's even more true in Hollywood and stuff like that, like once you played a mom, you can't go back to being like the
like
super hot action star girlfriend or whatever. Like,
not happening.
You're just trapped in the mom role.
Yeah,
and it's funny because I don't know how old Gina Rowlands is when this was made, but she doesn't actually look old at all. Like,
well, I think that's part of it. Yeah. Well, I think she was born in like 1930, so she's like in her late 40s or something.
Oh, really? I would have guessed she was like maybe 40 at the most.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I think that's part of why she's like FBO, not 65. I'm not going. I don't have hot flashes.
Oh yeah, that's
that was a funny line. Possibly, yeah. That's a pretty good summation of why the play sucks. Out on yeah. the stage having hot flashes. Very clunky.
I did like that part when Sarah's talking about she's like, yeah, for 1 year I was just 18. Told everyone I was 18, but I was actually 16. That made me like her a little bit. Yeah. It's like, man, if I get to 60, maybe that's what I'll do. Just be like, how old are you? I'm 18.
The reverse of what, you know, old Ben Shapiro says, you can't do that.
There's also a lot of, like, Sarah and people projecting on her that her issues with age have to do with these things, like mm-hmm. missing out on, like, being married or having a family or being sexually precocious or whatever. But there's also a part in the beginning where Maurice is like, you don't care about personal relationships, you don't care about anything, and I feel like that seems actually true of her.
Yeah,
and like that's part of why she doesn't understand this character.
Right, she only cares about acting.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Being the star.
Be that single.
She's just
line.
Worried that her roles are going to be limited. She doesn't mm-hmm. actually care about the other stuff.
Right, that she won't be able to play and the same long range anymore. Of characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So him saying that too, I mean, with any of the conversations between the actors in this, I feel like the context makes it kind of fuzzy as to if he's talking about her character because they are sort of methody, all of them seem a little methody, or if like he's talking about her directly. I mean, I think at the end of the day, the point is that they're like sort of one and the same, because I feel like there's mm-hmm. some commentary that when you're acting, you're putting a large chunk of yourself in there, but like you're never
well, her
quite...
name's Virginia in the play. That's her real name.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Gina, short for Virginia.
There we go. Oh, dear. That's all there. Yeah, but I do like how you can, like, you can never really take anything they're saying to one another, literally. And also, if she starts to seem to be, like, slipping into some sort of psychosis more and more, it becomes even harder to figure out. Like, there's that scene where Ben Gazzara admits to her that, like, he thinks the play sucks, too. Like, it seems so sudden. Like, it's even sudden in the conversation. Like, he's just, like, coming in to, like, give her a pep talk, and then all of a sudden he pivots really hard and just, like, caves, and it's just like, yeah, I know, this play's really boring, but, like, we gotta do it. And it's like, oh, no, is he, like, imagining that, too? Or, like, does he actually know this play sucks? He probably does. But...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, he could be just, you know, doing the coddling thing sure. in a different way of being, like, you know... This is what you want to hear, right? That this place sucks, that you're right. So
yeah.
Here I am telling it to you.
Yeah. And as such, it makes it hard to determine if any of the interpersonal relationships, like, actually are romantic. Like, it's pretty clear that it's not between her and Ben Gazzara, but, like, with her and, like, Cassavetes, it's, like, a little weirder. It's harder. Like, it seemed like they were hooking up before, but I can't say that for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think that I got that they had been in a relationship and then it just very recently ended. Yeah. And it's unclear if he, like, why it ended. Like, it sounds partly like he's like, I need to focus on this being this role and not being with you.
Mm-hmm.
But then it also seems like at another point he's like, when she's trying to go to him, like the night before opening night, he's like, you know, I know that who you are,
mm-hmm.
and that you don't actually want this thing with me. You just want to get me to do something with you on stage.
Right.
So.
Classic Tina. Well, it worked.
It's true.
A lot of fun. I like when he's being funny. Funny jazz that he is. I mean, it's probably like apparent at this point. I'm sure it's a sure thing, but like I feel like a lot of this is self-parody too, to some extent, or at least what's going on within the play. Because, I mean, but it's almost like him flexing and kind of. I know this along with basically everything else he did at the time didn't do well at all in America. Mm-hmm. Almost like, I mean, this one in particular, like essentially had to get a re-release in the 90s, right? Like it.
Like, no one saw it.
Yeah, like, it technically came out in the 70s, but no one showed up. But it almost seems like him coming back at, like, those critics who were complaining that he was, like, doing the same old, like, dreary thing, and it's just, like, people, like, alcoholics yelling at each other or whatever. And that seems to sort of be what the play is that they're doing. It's, like, a dumb version of that, but then, like, all the backstage antics mirror them, but are, like, so much smarter and so much more difficult to parse, and there's, like, a very interesting contrast between the two. Like, yeah, people do put out stuff like that, but it's not the same. Yeah.
No. Yeah, especially the part when, I forget his name, but the guy with the mustache starts, like, freaking out and, like, shoving everyone around. I'm like, oh, yeah.
That was a really good part of the play. Yeah. It was very funny how he kept shoving that, like, weird character. Like, we never get any explanation what that guy is doing in the play or, like, who he is outside of the play. He's just there for the one scene to get pushed around by the mustache guy a lot. Like, he just keeps getting shoved to the ground over and over again. It was very funny.
And then, like, the weird part at the end of that scene when that we only see it the very last time they perform it, where the guy's like, you can hit me, I love you, man. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, you're my best friend.
Yeah, like, yeah, oh, sorry. Yeah, a parody of, like, what people think of John Cassavetes, or also maybe someone like Sam Shepard that has similarly, like, like, vitriolic, just, like, irrational characters that are always doing really terrible things to each other, but...
For sure. Like,
amped up. And it was very funny that Bogdanovich showed up at the very end as part of the audience.
Oh, I missed that. That is fun.
The guy who's... Yeah, I didn't recognize him, but Ben Gazzara says his name really quickly. But the guy who's trying to talk to her about everything, and she's like, oh, you know, like, I can't do this right now, like... Blah, blah, blah. That's Peter Bogdanovich.
Nice cameo.
Yep.
And real patron of the arts. Yeah.
And it was also funny, all the, like, regulars that weren't in the play just show up at that point, like Seymour Cassell's there.
Oh, that's right.
Peter Falk.
Yeah. Couldn't have a movie without Falk.
That's true. You had
to shove him in somewhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But... I mean, it's interesting the sort of other kind of, like, ways that characters try to talk about aging, like, Cassavetes talks about his, like, graying temples, which seems, again, sort of, like, superficial, and then Ben Gazzara has that long scene in the diner where he's talking about, you know, how he tried to leave his wife for a 19-year-old, and then she said he was too old. And how humiliating it was having to go back to his wife.
Like, yeah.
That's his real takeaway. Like, not how humiliating it would be for his wife to be left for a 19-year-old. But
right. I did it. I went back to her. What a hero.
Tail between my legs.
Yeah. I know. The aging part still feels weird to me because the movie does such a good job of pushing back on that as being, like, a pretty... basic narrative with, like, limited things to mine from it, but it's also still legitimately on the movie's mind outside of the context mm-hmm. of the play. Like, it definitely is about aging. I mean, other movies of his definitely are too, so like something he's concerned about, but I don't know, it feels like he's undercutting himself a bit because he like knows it's like too talked about, and there's like it's a right. very challenging to have an original conversation about the detractions of aging. Challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the way that yeah, you have to make it compelling, just kind of have those conversations, but then also make fun of the people having them.
I think it works because of the dead fan character and the way they interact mm-hmm. with her too. And I think by the end you realize it's like, regardless of what actually happened to her, if she exists, it's like a vampiric relationship on the part of Gina Roland. And if she mm-hmm. did exist, then the other people do actually know about it. You know, I mean, it speaks to their kind of shallowness, their lack of like, any sort of morality, too. I don't know if she's actually... I don't know. What do you think she was trying to get out of that relationship? A potentially imaginary relationship?
That's a good question. I mean, some of it's like a weird projecting that people do like on dead people, like when there's like the part where she creates that talks about how she's like, oh, I've got this dead girl with me, she's so open, she's so blah blah blah, she, like all these nice things, and it's like she seemed like a weirdo amount that we saw her, like, but the way that it's easy to like project whatever characteristics you want on somebody once they're not there to mm-hmm. be themselves around you.
yeah. Draw off of the imagined pain of this life cut short. This girl just mm-hmm. loved having sex.
She's a free spirit.
Yeah. Based off of the little bit that we know about her. I don't buy that. Very socially awkward. Seemed to come from a very religious family.
Yeah. Fans are always weird.
Yep.
And it is uncomfortable when she goes to the funeral too.
I know.
It's like she's just so used to being, you know, welcome and wanted everywhere she goes. She can just like come to this girl's house while her parents are grieving.
Yeah.
So I feel, I don't know, that's kind of like she's using the dead or something.
Yeah.
She's like using her in a way that feels exploitative.
Yeah, I feel like the way that scene plays out, it kind of closes the door on the idea that any of her interest in this girl is actually like altruistic or like coming from some place of regret. It's just like, you're like, you shouldn't be here. And she's like, you know what? I shouldn't, but I'm going to keep on imagining this dead girl and drawing off of her for my purposes. Yeah.
And well, even when she initially, when she like is killed, like Gina Rollins is kind of freaking out about it, but it also seems like it's just because she freaks out about things to draw attention to herself, and mm-hmm. then like it becomes an excuse to try to get Maurice to come up to her room to like console her. So even then it's like it's hard to read how sincere her shock or grief is, because mm-hmm. it feels so just kind of like, oh, I'm going through this thing right now, people, you know, and getting Maurice to come up to her room and then calling, what's his name? Maddie or something.
Which one?
The director.
Oh, Ben Gazzara's character?
Ben Gazzara, yeah. Like calling Marty? Him in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Marty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And I think that that's like a similar thing that happens in Husbands, where like that movie starts with like it's like four guys, and then when the movie begins, one of them is dead. But then, like, the rest of the movie is, like, clearly pushed by that. But, like, also, most of the time, they don't seem like they like each other or cared about that guy that much. But they're just, like, using it as, like, an excuse for this, like, weird, crazy weekend, like, midlife crisis bender thing that they want to do. And this seems like a similar thing of, like, the way in which you can just use someone's death to, like, do what you want to do anyway. Like, I mean, like,
yeah, and it might also just be because that's just how she processes grief or whatever, is by drawing attention to herself in this way.
For sure.
So it's kind of both.
But I think Yeah, I mean, in a way, you could even maybe read that, like, the sort of, I mean, we could assume that she hated the play even before this happened and wasn't interested in doing it. So then, like, this whole thing is, like, an elaborate setup so that she can do whatever she wants to the play without mm-hmm. feeling like she has to be culpable to people. Mm-hmm. Because she's like, no, this horrible thing happened that I'm very traumatized by. And that's why I'm fucking with your play. Pretty cool. We've been watching a bunch of Cassavetes stuff. That was part of what gave the idea for it.
Yeah, totally. You're on a roll over there. How many you got left? Mm-hmm.
Well, he has, including the ones that people don't like because they're like the more like studio ones. I think yeah. he has like 11 or so movies.
Yeah.
And I've watched 4 of them so far. I mean, I watched A Woman Under the Influence a couple of years ago when we did an episode on it, but right. watched Husbands and Faces
nice.
And Opening Night, but want to watch them all. He's so great.
Might like, as well. Yeah, rack them up.
Yeah. It's so, I mean, Haley and I talked about this before, like, as we've been watching them, but it's interesting the way in which, like, his style is both so celebrated, well, now anyway, and, like, so unique, but, like, it feels like no one's actually even come close or particularly tried to, like, emulate it.
No, not really. The structure is so, so tight, but not, like, in, like, an annoying screenwriter-y way. I think kind of, like, going off that, but also thinking about how he's making fun of the play or, like, using it as an example of, like, what not to do. It's like a dumb play, but the way that he paces it out in the movie makes it interesting. Like, you'll see, like, 3/4 of a scene, and then he'll restart it later on, like, a half hour later in the duration of the movie, and, like, you'll start before what you saw, and you'll see a little bit after, and, like, it adds, like, new tension to it. His editing is very clever and very tight and on point. Good at editing for humor, too. That whole scene with Ben Gazzara and his wife. And he gets off of the phone and, like, tries to, like, apologize and get her to have sex with him. And she's like, yeah, let's not be phony about it. And, like, they just cut the scene. And you don't have to keep watching it. It's so good. I didn't want to see the rest of that scene. Yeah.
For sure.
I know. I feel like he becomes, like, a reference point for modern independent filmmakers in, like, a very superficial way. Just like, oh, like, there's a lot of close-ups. And the dialogue's kind of snappy and mean, like, pretty Cassavetes-esque, but, you know, that's reductive. He's got a lot of, like, deep ideas going on in, like, the actual formalist filmmaking's way miles ahead.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, we talked about it before, but, like, and I think I even mentioned it when I heralded Husbands, but also, like, the kind of irrationality of it is, like, part of what makes it so compelling is, like, people will, like, their emotions turn on such strange dimes yeah. that, like, you know, I mean, it obviously creates, like, this sense of, like, all the people just harboring these deep resentments that are, like, exploding out at, like, inopportune moments. But it's so, I don't know, it just takes so much, like, trust, I guess, in the audience to get it, and also in the actors to, like, convincingly just, like, get mad over something that feels like not, like, a real slight at all, or, like, anything Fairly. That would generate, like, that kind of explosion. But
yeah,
their motives are always, like, not very clear,
right?
In a way that's really interesting.
I think with the dialogue too, it feels really real. It's, like, definitely not naturalistic dialogue, but the way he writes it and, like, kind of the strange sentence patterns he uses, there's something about it that ends up feeling a little more honest and real, even though it is still very screenwritery at the same time. Like, I usually don't like screenwritery dialogues, but his is, like, tweaked in this way that gives it this strange dissonance that ends up feeling more honest than it would have for whatever reason. What he's doing there. Good
screenwriter. Yeah. He's just great at writing. Very rude.
Yeah.
unfair to the rest of us.
Good at everything.
But yeah, it's pretty cool to have found out. Like, I mean, I think Haley was the one that told me that his movies are essentially like self-financed. Like him and
Gina
Rowlands just use their own money, hang with their friends,
creeping by.
He was like taking out second mortgages on his house and stuff.
It's very sad.
It is, but shines through that like passion and desperation. He obviously cared. Great. Yeah. He wasn't making these movies just to make them.
It's true.
Oh, man.
Or to cash in. I am pretty curious about, like, because he did Shadows and then he did two movies that most people don't really like that are considered, like his attempt to, like, work within the studio and do, like, real studio movies.
Too Late
and
Blues.
Yeah. And then he gave that up to do Faces and more or less never turned back, but I'd be curious to see that tension between him trying to do his thing with weird studio restrictions.
I tried watching Too Late Blues once and found it pretty boring, but I should return to it. Some Rat Pack members in it, I think.
Right. Cool.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I don't think so.
How was Faces? Did Faces hold up?
Yeah, I like Faces. I think Haley liked it more than me.
Mm-hmm.
Although I can't exactly say why I didn't like it as much as the other three that I've seen, which I liked a lot for all of them.
Yeah, I think I only like Faces slightly less than Husbands in Opening Night, but I don't know if I have any strong reasons for that.
All right, I'll take it.
They're all pretty sad.
Yeah, get to see that craggy face up close. Yeah.
Yeah, I was all confused because I knew that Seymour Cassell was in it, but then I was like, he takes so long to show up in it that I was like, oh wait, is this main dude Seymour Cassell? How can he look 80 years old like for the last like 50 years? But then when he actually shows up, I'm like, oh no, he is actually young.
Yeah.
It's this guy, obviously.
Hot Seymour Cassell. Prime of his life.
A little hippie boy.
Like, oh, hey. Really gets her.
Yeah. Macking on all those ladies. Sad, sad life.
Grim world he was living in.
It's true. All right, well, yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks for appearing, Mitchell and Haley.
Of course.
Obviously. Mm-hmm. Both come back soon.
Dream
and
team.
Start our own offshoot podcast.
Yeah. The Looser Cannons.
So go to our website, loosecannons.net. Support our Patreon. We got a Patreon now. Give us money.
Nice.
It costs money to have this website, and it's nice, so we want to keep having it.
Good website.
And, that's it. All right, thanks. My first time hosting. Pretty exciting. Okay.
The host with
jumping
the most.
All over the place. Yeah. All right, so thanks for listening, everybody, and see you soon. Bye.
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 I'm supposed to say bye.